exist yet. We've been working on the book for about 3 or 4 years, and I'll talk a little bit about the genesis of the book, and it should be coming out from next year, published by me and possibly other publishers. Just to sort of make an announcement at the beginning, we have three presentations. The fourth presentation was to be by Rob Lucas, but very sadly his child Sasha has an extremely rare condition and requires treatment in LA. So the first thing I'm going to do today is just to announce a crowdfunding campaign. So Rob and Zoe, Sasha's parents, need about £20,000 very urgently to give their very young child Sasha cheap treatment for a very unusual condition, which can only be treated, there's only one kind of clinic in the world that can kind of treat this condition, potentially make a difference as to whether this kid is going to be able to walk or, you know, have a kind of life at all. So Rob asked me to just put up the crowdfunding link, and there it is. So a little bit about the book. Mateen, who kind of initiated this project, held a series of seminars in the Basque Country, workshops, kind of readings of the concept of real subsumption about 4 years ago. I kind of contributed to that series, and then there was kind of seminar, which essentially, So, Mateen, could you help me just get the table of contents on the screen?
Yeah.
I can't operate it. So, essentially, the beginning of the book involved a seminar with about half of the contributors giving papers. So that was Marina Vischmidt, Rob Lucas and Zoe from Endnotes, Mateen, myself, Federico Corriente, Dimitri Catuza, and Ray Brassier on Skype. This kind of, essentially at the kind of initial moment of the book, was a response to a debate that began by Endnotes, the kind of UK and US collective known for kind of developing theories of communization. They'd published a text in their second edition called History of Subsumption. It was kind of made a significant intervention in debates around the term subsumption, real subsumption, formal subsumption. There was a kind of convergence of a number of kind of people working around this term. Andres Sáenz de Sicilia recently completed a PhD on subsumption in Kant, Marx and Hegel. And essentially after the kind of initial seminar, we kind of began to kind of like bring in and kind of other kind of, I guess, fragments of a kind of debate, a kind of fairly like lively, conscious, specific debate around the term subsumption. I'm just going to kind of read a little bit from our kind of introduction, because we've now done a few events around this, around the book. The book's kind of like, it's not super, super urgent. It doesn't address necessarily like precise political struggles right now, but it does kind of try to respond to this kind of recent theorization, historical and recent theorizations of the term subsumption, and kind of like address all sorts of conditions that kind of unfolded after the financial crisis. So I'll just read a little bit from one of our introductions to a recent event in Poland. Following the financial crisis and ongoing social struggles all over the world, we witness the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. We don't seem to have a credible political horizon able to prevent this from continuing. We're aware that we urgently need to intervene in social reality, and in order to do so, we first have to understand it. the social reality is becoming increasingly sophisticated, accelerated, and changeable. What theoretical tools would allow us to think adequately about this particular time in history? Where could we find such tools in this cultural landscape of ruins? Once again, we come to the same question: what is to be done? Or to put Lenin's famous question and Marx's concept together, what is to be done under real subsumption? And that's a kind of deliberately awkward kind of compound. It's kind of like it kind of generates many more questions than it kind of answers. We have kind of a few attempts to come to an answer, but not a definitive one. So the concept of subsumption, following Marx's description in Capital Volume 1 and the results and various earlier manuscripts, drafts for Capital, pertains strictly to the description of the production process. Attempts to use the term to describe the rationalization of aspects of social life falter because the category ceases to critically describe a dynamic relation between formal subsumption, the employment of relations of production as capital finds them, and real subsumption, the seizure and development of social production in capital's own image. Since the rediscovery of so-called Volume 4 of Capital, or Chapter 6, in the mid-1970s, subsumption began a rich afterlife, with intense debates ensuing over whether it should be understood as a historical or logical category. Attempts to use subsumption as a category of periodization are arguably problematic, because what are proposed as distinct phases of capital's development in fact reappear and continue to coexist historically. Not only do forms of real and formal subsumption coexist, they're distributed unequally geographically. These phases do appear to take place sequentially in certain branches of industry, and one can outline the shift from one stage to another, but equally those industries move geographically, resettle, recompose, and reincorporate the so-called earlier stage in a new setting, and integrated vertically into a global system of production, which includes both highly developed technological production and apparently artisanal or primitive forms. So just to quickly, this is kind of draft table of contents for the book, what you see. So I'll just try and give a very brief summary of maybe these texts or what their significance is for the book. So we begin with kind of an introduction and overview by the two editors, myself and Martin. The first text is is Subsumption and Regressive Social Necessity, which is translated by Andres, who's sitting to my left. This text by Bolivar Echeverria is kind of very interesting because it attempts to introduce in a Mexican context, for a Mexican journal, kind of introduce a number of fragments from Marx's writings on specifically on the concepts of subsumption to a kind of Latin American Marxist milieu. The next text is a kind of preface or introduction by the translator of Federico Corriente of the first kind of introduction of subsumption as a term into the French left communist milieu in 1971. That text is called Negation, called The Proletariat as Destroyer of Work. It's published by a small group called Negation, who then basically several lines kind of fork out of Negation, and they become, a part of that group becomes Theory Communiste. But afterward, there's then the first English translator, first English translation of The Proletariat as Destroyer of Work, an extremely long exploration of subsumption in the post-68 context in France. And then that's followed by a postface by Roland Simon, who's a member of Theory Communiste, who was also a member of the group Negation, who wrote the text. That's the kind of small group of historical, it's not sort of a synthesis of all European debates, but I think Martin will cover some of that framework, and I will cover some of that framework in the introduction. Then there's a series of texts which relate to current debates. Andres's text is kind of put down as Time of Subsumption. That's likely to be a different text. The text will probably touch on that and what he'll talk about. today we'll probably touch on that. Then there's a long text by Thierry Communis, Real Subsumption, the Contradiction Between Proletariat and Capital. That's very much a revisitation of this debate with endnotes. That's a kind of currently unpublished, or maybe published text. It's a text by Ray Brassier, Wandering Abstraction, which was very much a kind of response to the debate around endnotes, and kind of brings maybe some different kind of tools, some sort of a different kind of account of Marxism, different kind of tools to debate about subsumption. Keepsakes by Dmitry Kazuza is a response to Ray Brassier's text, which stresses a kind of communization, insurrectionist position. Feeding the Infant by Rob Lucas, who's absent, sadly, is also a kind of response on behalf of Rob and Endnotes to a whole series of critiques of Endnotes' position. Spain and the Origins of Communization Theory by Federico Corriente kind of explores a little bit the relevance of subsumption as a term to kind of Spanish, a history of the Spanish ultra-left. The Fantasy of Subsumption by Nadia Bou Ali again kind of brings a different set of tools, kind of set a kind of almost like Lacanian Marxism to bear on this kind of subsumption debate, specifically endnotes again. My text, This Implies Nothing, is like an account of the political economy of the Frankfurt School, what's wrong with it, and how they kind of buried and disguised the concept of subsumption and a kind of philosophy of history, kind of neo-Marxian philosophy of history, in their kind of like pre and post-war work. Procedures of Abolition and Several Paradoxes They Brought Up by Marina Verschmidt is very much addressing the concept of subsumption and the kind of discussions of self-abolition that are quite approximate, or the abolition of work. And Marina's going to present today a kind of updated version of that text. And then the book ends with a kind of series of dialogues. One is a second reply by Dmitry Kazuza to Ray Brassier, and then the third is an intervention by an Argentinian group, Cuadernos de Negación, who kind of followed these discussions in kind of by coming to the seminar in the Basque Country, and also by just kind of in a way absorbing the debates around subsumption from quite a distance. So, with no further ado, I'm going to pass on to Andres Sanz de Sicilia. The order of speakers is more as you see them, from right to left. Andres, then Marina, then Matti.
Okay, thanks. So I'm going to do something a bit informal. I really just want to make some comments based on the issues that I raised in the book and the way that some of the work that I've done around subsumption intersects with that. So, as Anthony was saying, I did a long research project looking at the philosophical background to subsumption and how that informs and can inform a Marxist use of the concept of subsumption. And that project arose basically from a dissatisfaction with the way in which the concept of subsumption was being used. So I went back to some of the texts in which the concept was developed and transformed, basically in German philosophy, and tried to draw some resources from that literature, which could then be read back into the Marxist debates on subsumption, because I had the sense that the richness of the concept of subsumption in the philosophical literature wasn't really carried over into the Marxist debate. So one of the ways of trying to open up some of the problems and blockages that were present in the Marxist discussions around subsumption. So I want to just try and briefly map out what I understand to be the problematic, or the set of problematics underlying the debates around real subsumption. Now I'm just going to make a few comments on the relationship between real subsumption, or capitalist subsumption more generally, and time and subjectivity, which I think are two directions or angles that need to be pursued in order to find a bit of a way out of the impasse that has emerged, or exists in some form at least, in some of the Marxist debates. So to begin with, I just want to outline what I see to be the four core theoretical issues at stake in the debates around real subsumption. There's three which are more explicitly formulated, and there's a fourth which I think is kind of an implicit problem underlying the discussions. So the first and more kind of most basically is basically just, you know, subsumption is about, and real subsumption in particular, is about how capitalist domination is conceptualized. Okay, so how we understand capitalist domination to function. Okay, so the precise mechanism of capitalist social regulation and control. Okay, so how does it actually work? What is going on? What does it mean to say individuals, workers, labor is subsumed under capital? What's the actual mechanism that's being described or referred to there? And by implication, it's also a question about how resistance against this particular form or this mechanism of domination is conceptualized. The second problematic is, or the second issue would be, how the effects of capitalist domination, so the effects of this form of domination on social life, are conceptualized, and in particular on the historical development of social life. So how capitalist power and struggles against it shape the course of human history. So how social development unfolds under the condition of this form of domination. Thirdly, and related to the previous two, is a problem around the deepening of capitalist control. So this is, if you like, the most emphatic, or probably the most explicitly problematized issue in much of the literature on subsumption. So it's about the deepening of capitalist control via the mechanism of real subsumption. So how is it that real subsumption actually produces a kind of intensification, a sort of imperious deepening of capitalist control over social life, and what this in turn means for the possibility of a revolutionary rupture with capitalist social reproduction. And then the fourth issue, which is not thematized so explicitly in the debates on real subsumption, but I think it's a crucial question which is there in the background, would be something like that, what we could call the anthropological question of capitalist subsumption. So how does capitalist subsumption modify the configuration of the human, okay, of workers and of human society? So what recomposition of humanity at both a singular and a collective level does real subsumption bring about? So I think that those are broadly the main issues which are at stake in some of the debates that we can find around real subsumption. And I think that they all, in a sense, draw on or refer to, maybe it's better to say they kind of give life to the problematic status of real subsumption, both within Marx's writings and within Marxism, so within the kind of literature that's followed and drawn on what Marx says about subsumption. So in Marx's own writings, subsumption is, there's a kind of a few issues around subsumption which I think is reflected in the debates which have come afterwards. So to begin with, Marx just doesn't talk about subsumption that much, so he has a fairly minimal account of subsumption. He uses the concept in various ways throughout pretty much all of his writing career. So from the very earliest writings, where his critique of Hegel, he's using subsumption in the way that Hegel uses it in the philosophy of right. So he's thinking about subsumption very early on, but it never becomes a central concept or category for him. So his comments are fairly cursory on subsumption. He doesn't provide a very developed theoretical account of what subsumption is. So firstly, there's a bit of a paucity of textual resources to draw on within Marx's own writings. There's also, to some extent, an apparent hesitation with the way that Marx uses subsumption. So in the drafts of his critique of political economy, Marx is using subsumption, but then in the final published versions of Capital, it's pretty much eliminated. So there's a question there about how subsumption can be systematically integrated into the critique of political economy, and there's been sort of different positions taken on this and the importance or not of subsumption for Capital and for the critique of political economy. So there's a series of issues and open questions produced by these kind of ambiguities in Marx's own writing. So, you know, most basically, what is subsumption? So what kind of, you know, is it a process, is it a relation, what kind of process or relation is subsumption? These are things which are not entirely clear if you just look at what Marx writes, so it requires some interpretation. And then questions, you know, how does subsumption actually work? So Marx describes particular mechanisms going on, and he has this kind of basic distinction between formal and real subsumption, but there's still more to be said, really. So how does subsumption actually work, and what can be done with it conceptually? So how useful is it? What is its place within Marx's theoretical project? This has kind of been an important problem within the debates. And in particular, how does it sit with relation to the other key categories of Marx's project, so things like value, labour, abstract labour, capital, class, etc., and to other proximate concepts of domination. So if we're thinking of subsumption as a concept of domination, how does it connect with other concepts of domination that Marx uses, like exploitation, alienation, inversion, and fetishism? So the tensions and ambivalences which I think can be found in Marx's own comments on subsumption give rise to a, you know, need, I think, to examine the conceptual framework of subsumption as such. So not just to look at real subsumption, but to think about what is going on. What does Marx mean when he talks about subsumption? So think about the concept of subsumption more generally. In terms of real subsumption as such, one of the key problems is that there is, in Marx's writings, an apparently linear and necessary transition between formal and real subsumption. And this seems to suggest something like a kind of linear developmental schema which is imminent to the process of accumulation. So the idea is a kind of necessary development always from formal to real subsumption, and this is a kind of template of social development. So on a certain reading, this transition, or the apparent necessity of this transition, forms the basis for a kind of historical blueprint of how capitalist societies develop. So I think that the kind of the more focused problem, or the key question around real subsumption itself, would be that of the theoretical articulation between Marx's account of the capitalist production process and the logic which is internal to the production process, so a logic of constant innovation and technical restructuring, which is really at the heart of real subsumption. How that can be articulated with then the account of the overall process of accumulation, so the entire total process of capital accumulation, and then the total process of social reproduction, so the total process by which a society as such reproduces itself as a whole, both in terms of its subjective and objective factors or conditions. So I think this, the problematic then of conceptualizing subsumption and real subsumption, turns on this question of how we understand the articulations between these three levels, between the production process, between the accumulation process, and then between the social reproduction process as a whole. Because the analysis that Marx gives of real subsumption is located primarily at the level of the production process, there has been a tendency in the literature to extrapolate a developmental schema based on what Marx describes as occurring in the production process. So to extrapolate the description of what goes on there in production and to project it onto the social whole in a kind of unmediated way. Yeah, so we could understand the way in which the social whole functions and the way in which the social whole develops by a kind of metonymic analysis of the production process. So the most sort of infamous initial adoptions of the concept of subsumption in the Marxist literature do exactly this. And so they put subsumption to work as a concept of historical periodization. And I think there's sort of two forms in which this occurs. There's a more benign form and then a more extreme or problematic form. So the more benign form would just be to think that it's possible to map the overall historical development of human society using an analysis of the forms of subsumption, so formal and real subsumption in the production process, to treat this somehow as a kind of basic model or template of historical development under capitalist conditions. And then the second, more extreme form extends this and proposes a kind of completion or totalization of this development. So it proceeds from formal to real to a kind of total subsumption. And you get this, I think, most emphatically in the work of Adorno and Horkheimer in some texts, on the one hand, and then Negri on the other. So in Adorno and Horkheimer, you get this idea of total administration, so a society that's become totally administered. Everything is subject to a kind of capitalist command. And very similar thesis is proposed by Negri when he talks about kind of total subsumption. Okay, there's nothing left outside of production. The entire society has become a factory for Negri. And there's other, so in the Théorie Communiste text as well, and people like Frederick Jameson also kind of use this idea of that we're now in a period of total subsumption. So I think what goes on with this reading of real subsumption is a kind of displacement or dissolution of the problematic of subsumption. So it actually kind of dissolves the very problematic itself, because real subsumption ceases to be about how capitalist control and regulation actually function, and it just turns into a kind of assertion that they have become total or absolute. So there's no longer a problem of how domination functions once it's become absolute, once capital controls everything. So the problem is kind of displaced, it's taken away. And there's been, then in the literature, there's been, I guess, two different angles of a response to this total subsumption thesis. So recognizing that the concepts of subsumption are not historical categories, and that they don't, you can't coherently use them to denote periods or phases of human society under capitalist conditions. So the rejection, the recognition of that, and the rejection of the total subsumption thesis, I think, has led to two different approaches. One is to just simply reject the concept of subsumption, or the value of using Marx's concepts of subsumption within a Marxist theoretical framework, or to demote them to a very kind of limited place within that framework. And I think this approach is basically internal to the problematic of periodization. So the idea is, because they can't be used effectively to periodize, they're not useful concepts. This approach will be internal to the problematic of periodization, and also to a particular kind of peculiar notion of struggle and revolution, which is bound to the problematic of periodization. Okay, so we need to understand resistance, struggle, and revolution through kind of a periodizing approach to the history of capitalism. That periodization kind of gives the key to understanding revolution, the possibility or not of revolution. The other approach has been a bit more conservative, perhaps, which is to simply try and locate some theory of subsumption within an already extant and well-understood Marxist framework. So basically, to try and integrate subsumption within Marx's value theory and within a kind of systematic dialectic of capital. So people like Chris Arthur and Patrick Murray have done this in various ways. And this is based on very useful and interesting close theoretical work with Marx's text. So it's very useful research. But essentially, what they're trying to do is integrate subsumption within to value theory. So I think that we can also detect a kind of a second form of displacement or dissolution of the difficulty which lies at the centre of subsumption here. So ultimately, what you get is a kind of separation of subsumption from history in these accounts. Yeah, so you have a purely sort of systematic or synchronic conception of capitalist subsumption. So there's a reaction to the bad historicization or the periodization that you get in Adorno and Negri and others. Subsumption becomes, as a reaction, treated on the basis of a purely synchronic analysis of capital. So it becomes frozen in historical time, or completely abstracted away from historical time in its unfolding. So I think that this displaces the problem, because subsumption, of course, is partly about the way in which capitalist society develops. That's what's described with real subsumption. It's about a transformation of society. And I mean, I'll say a little bit more in a minute about why I think this is the case, but it can't just be limited to an analysis of the production process. And I think another sort of second issue which emerges in the context of these responses is that subsumption loses its character as a mediating category. So it ceases to be a category of struggle, because it's a category which is made internal to value theory. So it becomes about a unilateral imposition of something onto labour, and the capacity of labour to constitute a kind of resistant force is either denied or just not accounted for. So I think Chris Arthur, for example, he raises it as a kind of postulate. So he says, well, of course, Labour resists, but it's in no way integrated or given space within the theory. Okay, so it becomes the idea that subsumption is a category of struggle, and in particular it's a category which connects the economy and the whole entire sphere of value and the representation involved in value of human activity, that mediation which connects it with real human activity and real human subjects is lost, okay, because it becomes internalized to a kind of capitalist totality. And in particular this emerges when I think there's an attempt to correlate formal and real subsumption with absolute and relative surplus value production. So to simply say that that's another name for relative or absolute surplus value production. Okay, so I think there's these two forms of displacement or two forms of closure, which can be detected within some of the responses to the problem of real subsumption in Marx's text. And so they're forms of closure in the sense that the first form, the kind of total subsumption thesis, is a kind of diachronic closure because it says basically history is over, or at least the history of capitalist development is over. There's just a kind of totalized form now of capitalist command. And then in the more value theoretical approaches, there's a kind of diachronic closure because it freezes the process of development and it simply accounts for subsumption in terms of a systematic totality. So I think in order to kind of find some ways forward in terms of thinking about subsumption and the productivity of subsumption as a concept, it's necessary to break with these two forms of closure, both to treat subsumption as something historical, so a historical process and relation, but not a historical process in relation which simply enumerates a kind of template of linear development. Okay, so to find another way of thinking the historical character of subsumption. And at the same time, to treat subsumption as something systematic, systematically basic to capitalist reproduction, which I think is lost in both Negri and Adorno, where it just becomes totalized. So it has a kind of systematic function and a systematic... It fits within the systematic structure of capitalist reproduction, but it's not frozen in time. Okay, so to find a way to kind of liberate it from this kind of frozen, synchronic, systematic dialectic. Okay, so it's not frozen in time and it's not unaffected by the concrete unfolding and transformation in the character of capitalist social reproduction. So again, I think this comes back to the question of how to theoretically relate those three levels which I set out earlier. So the production process, the accumulation process, and then the social reproduction process. So to try and negotiate some of these questions and to think about the relation between those three levels, in some of the research I've done, I've tried to really explore the concept of subsumption as such and think about what's at stake in subsumption as a process and relation. And I think there's three kind of key aspects to the concept which need to be kind of conceptualized together. The first is that subsumption is always a mediating category. So it's always a category which connects two different kinds of elements or two different levels of a system. And this is an innovation which you first find in Kant's philosophy. So rather than just becoming a kind of abstract relation of categorization or classification, becomes a productively mediating category in which you get different kinds of entities, different kinds of elements or different levels become synthetically related and brought into a kind of productive relation. And I think that this has to be taken seriously when thinking about capitalist subsumption, because it demands a kind of interrogation of what is the relation of mediation between capital and labour. And how does this actually function? And I think the work of Echevarria, which is going to be in the book, is quite important because he really develops this and he thinks about how to extend this mediation beyond just an analysis of the subsumption of labour in the production process and to think of it at the level of social totality. So how is there a kind of relation of subsumption at the level of the reproduction of capital and the reproduction of society, so the material reproduction of society. And that's something which I think has to be brought into relief. And has become, it's become something which people have rejected as a result of this kind of bad totalization that you get in Negri and Adorno. So there's been a kind of limitation of the description of subsumption to the production process, but I think there is a kind of subsumption which occurs at the level of the social totality, although its character is quite different from what occurs in the immediacy of the production process. The second aspect is that subsumption describes something like a regulatory process. So what's described by Marx with subsumption, it's not a unilateral form of production. So capital is not producing, but capital is regulating certain forms of material production. And I think this is particularly important in relation to time and subjectivity. So it's not that capital produces a kind of time or capital produces subjects, but capital regulates the process by which time and subjectivity, as well as commodity, etc., are produced. And I think that's kind of really like the specific structure of control which is implied in Marx's account of subsumption. So it's a form of command which regulates processes of material production. And finally, subsumption is a process of form determination. And this is kind of basic to the concept of subsumption as such in its philosophical use as well. So in terms of it's the mediation that's involved between two elements or two levels, that mediation as a subsumptive relation is a relation of form determination. So it's about one level giving a form which is imposed upon the other level. So that's what's occurring, I think, in this mediation. It's a kind of form determination. In the context of Marx's understanding of subsumption and capitalist subsumption, it's a process of social form determination. So capital provides the social form which is determined on labour and then on the social reproduction as a whole by the regulation of production. This is how these three aspects start to fit together. So taking a step back from some of the aporias that you find in the debates on real subsumption and considering these three more general aspects of the concept as such, I think enables us to explore some of the core contentions of Marxism as such, as a project of theoretical comprehension which is bound to a horizon of communist transformation. So kind of bringing these more general theoretical concerns back into these debates around what's going on with, for example, the technical transformation of the labour process and what that means for workers. So I think I'm running out of time, so I won't really say much about time and subjectivity, but just to kind of give a brief indication of why I think these are important aspects in terms of taking the theory of subsumption forward. Subjectivity is particularly important because I think that it's not possible to locate the effects of subsumption in the production process as such, or to kind of isolate them to production. What you see is that real subsumption in particular doesn't just transform what goes on in the production process, but as an effect of doing that, it has effects which implications which move throughout the entire social reproduction process. So what goes on with real subsumption is the technical character of the labour process is changed, but this changes the way in which people work, what they produce, so kind of the kind of commodities that can be produced. It has effects on the value of labour power, so kind of things which move throughout the economy as a whole. So there are shifts which work throughout the economy as a whole, but also because of the changes in the products that are produced and products in particular that are consumed by workers, it brings about a kind of recomposition of the subjectivity of workers as such. So the question of subjectivity is key, and it's one of the threads which connects what goes on in production with the entire social reproduction process. So this is traced to an extent in Marx's own writings, but in value terms. So it's traced objectively in terms of economic value. It's not traced in terms of workers' subjectivity. At least that account is not developed to such an extent. But of course, if you read it just in value terms, you can't actually understand what's going on with real subsumption because, for example, Marx talks about the reduction in the value of labour power, but when there's a transformation in the subjective character of workers, this also changes the very possibility of their exploitation. So the resistance which goes on in work is conditioned by what occurs with real subsumption in a mediated way that works through the entire social reproduction process. It's not just in production and it's not just in reproduction. Okay, I'll leave it there.
So thanks for coming this morning. Thanks for inviting me on the panel, and thanks to Andres, whose project of conceptual clarification I feel a lot of affinity with, even though what I'm going to say will not be quite so clear or systematic. But yeah, I think what you're doing is super useful. So I'm just going to start with a bit of a recapitulation of the approach that I took to writing the text that will be in the book, sort of reconstructed in rough terms, and then go into a few methodological comments that I've been working with or through since then. So the text was primarily intended for myself, first of all, as a way of diagramming or even just mapping certain questions that came up for me in the relationship between critical and revolutionary concepts that sounded analogous in the kind of radicality of their negation or their will to negate, or the intensity of their rejection, and which maybe had decisive links, but were coming out of quite different philosophical trajectories, namely, on the one hand, open Marxism and materialist and Marxist feminism, and on the other, left Heideggerianism as articulated in contemporary engagements with the Black radical tradition on the other. And that those are concepts of negation and abolition primarily. So that might be jumping ahead a bit towards the kind of revised and updated version of the text that I will give you a few extracts of in a few minutes. But basically I was interested at the time that I was writing, that is, that I first started writing it and presented it at the first kind of event, which was in late 2014, the first event of this project, in articulating three moments. The notion of abolition and self-abolition in contemporary left communist theory that was then being discussed under the rubric of communization. So one, two, the so-called radical feminism of the 1970s in its kind of more or less anomalous French and Marxist variant in the form of Monique Wittig's One Is Not Born a Woman essay. And finally, the notion of the nothing in always already dehumanized and commodified Black life in the historical shadow of chattel slavery as developed by the poet and aesthetic theorist Fred Moten. So these were kind of like the three trajectories I sort of whimsically was bringing together. So my aim in this kind of mapping was to look at the vicissitudes of the use of negation in these forms of thought and their implications for communist politics. So also like this emphasis on negation or interest in negation, maybe it could also gesture to the paradoxically, given the title, rich set of arguments in Anthony's text, This Implies Nothing, which is in the book. So the reason I was interested in these three trajectories in particular was how the authors approached mediation as part of their outlining of negation, and thus in my reading history. What I kept coming across was that concepts such as abolition, and especially self-abolition, had historical content, which was highly plural, but that the contemporary deployment of that concept in the theory I was looking at was sometimes of a kind that seemed to evacuate history from the picture, as well as mediation and the register of the strategic, and thus abolition seemed to emerge as a highly abstract concept, picking up on some of Marx's sense of a simple abstraction, although without the kind of dimension of ideological common sense that he tends to frame those kinds of concepts within. So classically, in his discussion, the naturalist positivist concept of population, for example. Nonetheless, it was important, these kind of discussions of abolition, self-abolition, were, to my mind, important as a gesture in thought, since even if the gesture was a kind of attempt at absoluteness, ended up at a certain level of generality, and thus perhaps vacancy, it seemed to be what seemed to me to be going in the right direction, having the possibility of being made or becoming determinate. And I had the same impression of, I talked about this more in my paper on Friday, the same impression of the kind of Afro-pessimist concept of the world or destroying the world, which implies, or rather argues, reform is not possible, and all previous revolutions have been reformist, inasmuch as we are still living in the same world, basically, when it comes to, at a minimum, race, gender, and class, or even the notion of the human that synthesizes these social descriptions. Which, and in my mind, that really kind of echoed some of the arguments in communization theory to an extent. Although, again, from an ontological, or a admittedly ontological, rather than perhaps crypto-ontological point of view. So in parallel to that, I was interested in relating the discourse of abolition to this discourse of destruction as a way of questioning the way abolition has traditionally been linked to the self-abolition of the proletariat in Marxist theory, and then how that moves through the self-abolition of those relations considered structurally non-central in orthodox and even many left and ultra-left versions of Marxist theory, namely gender and race, and through the critical projects that develop, conversely, their centrality as social forms, as aspects of the value relation, as totally structuring and pervading the experience and technology of class in capitalist modernity. So with that summary, where does this kind of meta-level diagramming come in, aside from the kinds of questions that I've already mentioned? So this is also something that comes up in the discussions explored in Rob Lucas's text on kind of false totalizations that was mentioned, the Feeding the Infant text. But I guess I was also very much interested in the desire for totalization in a lot of contemporary theory, in and out of the academy, for kind of preference for totalizing and absolutizing analysis, and the corresponding shunning of what I'd already mentioned as mediation, which can here also indicate in shorthand history and the historical, as well as strategic and institutional thinking. So I was kind of interested in this as a sort of intellectual structure and a structure of feeling or affect, the kind of absolutization, sort of desire for a kind of wiping clean slate that tends to accompany diagnoses of total subsumption. At the time, these struck me as kind of very aesthetic rather than specifically political moves, because they made for very sort of elegant formulations and were quite sort of affectively gratifying. So starting out with how these impulses operated within communization theory, while cutting across very dense historical, philological, and empirical work also going on in those publications and debates as well, whether it was the self-abolition of the proletariat or the abolition and self-abolition of gender, I saw it as well a few years down the line in what was termed Afro-pessimist theory, or studies of anti-blackness as an ontological, as a primarily ontological rather than historical phenomenon. So yes, I was at that point obviously quite intellectually and emotionally interpolated by that work, otherwise I wouldn't have been thinking about it. But I was also curious, especially as both sets of theoretical reflections were at various times and in various quarters taken up in academia and the world of cultural production and art, what it was that made it attractive in domains that that also kind of traffic in forms of radicalism that can be gestural. So I've always been investigating this kind of desire for political effect or kind of pathos of politics, the desire for politics in the art world, and what kinds of subjectivities that generates, because also due to kind of some of my early philosophical formation as a kind of crypto-Deleuzian, that desire is an active productive force and should be taken seriously, even if most of the time it's more of a capacity for adjustment or a facilitator for kind of passive or contemplative approaches, and even the sort of becoming an alibi for a sort of displaced authenticity. So anyway, what I wanted to do in these few remarks, and which I'm not going to have a great deal of time to do, because I'm also going to read a couple of paragraphs from the actual contribution to the book, is to look at concepts of concepts that work in this vein of totalization, like abolition, but like subsumption and like abolition, and to think about what kinds of desires those concepts are designed to respond to, and conversely, when we can think of those concepts more in kind of technical or specific terms, and then in turn, what the desire for precision and specificity is itself symptomatic of. So it's very easy to hear, and I certainly am very primed to hear, a kind of demand for specificity as a call for a return to order, or a kind of response constituted, for example, by those who divide from and elevate class over so-called identity politics, whenever the structural implications of gender, race, and other ascribed and socially effective mediations are put on the table. So it's not a plea for moderation made towards the extreme, a plea for reason made toward the righteous rage fueling kind of totalizing schemes. Though, as I say, there are those kinds of reactionary implications and reactionary categorizations that we have to consider whenever we desire specificity vis-a-vis the kind of vague and or emotive in political speech and political thought. Rather, I'd want to focus on how the desire for totalizations is really actually itself a desire for correctness or for correct analysis, and to maybe, and in a way to kind of come to the end of a process of analysis or a process of mediation. It's a desire in a way to have the correct analysis perhaps in the sphere of political groups, while in cultural and academic circuits, it can be a desire to evoke those levels of certitude and radical analysis to kind of cut through the proliferating vagueness all around with something that sounds decisive and perhaps theoretically rigorous. So this in itself, this kind of schema I'm devising here, should not be taken as a totalizing description, as a kind of hope that my reference to the elements of critical sociological and empirical work undertaken in the journals of communization that I was reading at the time I started doing this work, particularly Endnotes and their complicated relationship to notions of mediation through Hegel, would indicate. So when extending the discussion to contemporary theory formations in general, however, I would say that the conditions of the social reproduction of those formations in the Western and especially the US-based academy tend to favor the proliferation of conceptual commodities, the more performatively radical, the better, but that this is not inevitably a self-referential or a detached sphere, whether we're talking about activism or the migration of concepts. So here I think an important case study would be the currency of Afro-pessimist concepts in movements like Black Lives Matter and campus organizing in the US and some extent to the in the UK and elsewhere over the past several years, and how but also how this is not uncontested, for example, by writers and activists such as Moten or Avery Gordon or Robin D.G. Kelly, or indeed last night in the plenary, but also how these concepts operate in the street, how abolition becomes a concrete politics and program in something like the movement for the abolition of prisons, or the abolition of ICE, which is U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the internal border cops, as well as in what I would argue is definitely the other side of the political spectrum, abolitionism, the ideology that would get rid of sex work and sex workers while having no problem with any other kind of work, much less cops or capitalist exploitation. I think Koshka spoke a little bit about this in the plenary last night. A lot of contemporary theory mobilizes concepts of totalization, whether they are feel-good concepts such as multitude or feel-bad concepts such as abolition and world destruction. The role of communist theory in an optimistic view would be to put these concepts in motion from their pinnacle of traumatized radicalism to make them speculative rather than totalizing. Again, what I do want to emphasize, this is not a project of epistemic regulation and intellectual hygiene. It's the kind of unfreezing of the fast fixed that can only happen within collective processes such as debate, education, organizing, and struggle. Whereas holding abstractly radical position often leads to disappointment and a withdrawal from all those things, and a basically, if not always theoretically, conservative standpoint at the end of the day, or a kind of fidelity to radicalism but relocated to the right, where history and mediation really don't matter because they're submerged into violent myth. That's kind of my armchair psychotopography of contemporary theory out of the way. And now I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs from my text in the book. Yes. So then I guess this is maybe occurs in the beginning, but it's not a linear sample. So in what follows, I'd like to look at how ideas around abolition and self-abolition can help us understand the processes of dissolution and constitution implied by revolutionary transformation of social relations on the individual as well as collective level. Here, abolition is a perspective applying chiefly to the abolition of the social form women or the abolition of gender. With regard to other determinations, such as race, however, it also needs to be thought together with the calls for destroying the world that emerge from the thinking that gets called Afro-pessimism, or more cogently, the emergence of political ontologies around the histories and critiques of anti-blackness. Both can thus be connected to varieties of philosophical negativity in the Western tradition, of which the two most prominent are the dialectical one, negation as transformation, of Hegel, and ontological difference in Heidegger. Insofar as the abolition of gender is set out as the abolition of the institutionalized oppression, which is the content of the gender relation, it can be put more on the side of the Hegelian framework, whereas the destruction of the horizon of being, as it is predicated on anti-blackness, is the Heideggerian move set on the ontological difference of the black from the human in the Western, and not only Western, social and ethical imagination. First, however, I'd like to spell out the problematic of the subject of self-abolition as it figures as a radical appropriation of subjugated structural position that sees that position as both a lever to challenge the existing system of domination and as part of what has to be overcome within that structure, a question rather than a position, and one which takes in elements of the psychic, the subjective, and the historical. I found the problematic of self-abolition to be a productive way of joining the affirmative and negative moments of any radical emancipatory movement, be it class, gender, race, or other hierarchical and naturalized forms of exploitation and control. The analytic of self-abolition also offers a flexible level of abstraction which can both contextualize and interrogate the positing of any social antagonism or difference as primary, an argument from fundamentality which occurs in many radical social movements. Ultimately, it proposes a concrete emancipation to the whole where that oppression is reproduced. It in effect proposes another universality from below, or rather a fissure or a friction in the operation of universality itself. At the same time, the constitution of the collective self, which undertakes abolition as a political project of determinate negation, remains open to question, since the radical gesture of universality implies implicit in the liberation struggle can also reproduce the, so to speak, bad universalities of homogeneity and ahistorical community that underpins the oppressive social order itself. To account, then, for a self-abolishing subject of struggle means both formulating a subject which cannot be valorized or affirmed beyond the particular historical instances of those struggles, and an agency which drives the struggle that is not somehow already implicit within the social order to be countered or removed, an agency which may be seen as an activated negativity. So I think I'll stop there.
Thanks a lot. Thank you for everybody being here and for the presentations. So I'm just gonna, what I'm trying to do is basically following the discussion on self-abolition and trying to make sense out of it. So this it will follow into what Marina has been speaking. So the text, the name of the presentation is Negation of What We Are. Never before in the history of humankind we had so much access to our own history and knowledge. However, the future seems bleak, and some of the political options available here in Europe, for example, like Jeremy Corbyn, Syriza, or Podemos, do not go beyond the notion of the state and proposing to go back to some form of Keynesianism, which certainly could not work in the long run. We have very urgent problems that cannot be answered at the national level, like the refugee crisis, climate change, and the global rise of fascism. Even if struggles are happening all around the world, a radical political transformation at the global level seems very far away. Could be that the understanding, that we have of ourselves is precisely what is blinding us in conceiving a political transformation that will be able to cope with these changes. In order to answer this, I will trace a discussion on the notion of real subsumption, but more specifically on self-abolition, which is the kind of consequences of living in real subsumption. And I take as a starting point the text from Negation from 1972, the proletariat as destroyer of work. In this text, Negación claims that under conditions of real subsumption, which has been explained here very well, the proletariat is already through and through constituted by value and the class relation. Therefore, the self-affirmation of the class identity becomes only the affirmation of a category of capital, variable capital. Because of this, as part of the revolutionary process, the proletariat should abolish itself. Here we have what can be described as the necessity for a self-abolition in the revolutionary process. There are many consequences with this, and I think this text, why I think it's very important, is because it crystallizes a lot of, you know, like some of the arguments coming out of communization theory, which they come from a periodization of real subsumption, and they argue that under these conditions, this produces what they call the end of programmatism, the impossibility for the workers to have demands and any affirmative position of the proletariat. Negación in their text, which is a kind of brutal critique of many communist and left thinking that was happening at that time, criticize, among other things, democracy and the state, the first one because they see it rising hand in hand with the labor theory of value, and the second one, the state as being the regulator of economy. Their critique helps us to understand the limitations of new currents of social democracy, like the ones mentioned above, because they are being bound to fail because they are affirmating work. And this will only perpetuate work and capital. So the notion of self-abolition is the starting point of the book, one of the starting points of the book. Even if we cannot have a program, at least we have an answer to the question what is to be done, abolish ourselves. The answer is not that simple, and there are serious problems, and these problems are dealt with the book. One of them is brought up by Ray Brassiere in his text Wandering Abstraction, in what he calls the paradox of self-abolition, which is the following. If we are constituted by the class relation and we abolished ourselves, we are also abolishing the agent of the abolition, because we are nothing outside of this class relation. Therefore, the abolishing of ourselves is simultaneously cancelling its own cancelling power, and because of this, it is also a restatement of the we. In the book, we have several critiques to this paradox of self-abolition and some of the points raised by Brassiere in this text, and one of them comes from Dimitra Kotuza. For her, this is an exercise in logic that not takes into account the specificity of different subjectivities involved in the social struggles. For Kotuza, what is abolished in the process of self-abolition is not a general understanding of the we, but a we that contains oppressive valid social categories, such as proletariat, women, and black. Therefore, in the process of abolition developed through the pro-social struggles, the we becomes something else, something that is simultaneously singular and universal. But this has yet to be defined. And to what she describes the possibility of self-definition, of a redefinition of what is to be human. Okay, according to this perspective, one cannot anticipate beforehand what this redefinition will be, because it will only emerge through the struggles. Then we need to wait for these struggles, which in some ways it feels like a leap of faith, which I think a lot of the communization theory does feel like a leap of faith. And maybe this is the reason why it's like, you know, going down the interest, I don't know. But so according to this, we should abolish ourselves, but we cannot prefigure or not prepare for the process in advance, and we don't know where it will take us. Other critiques that Dimitra does to Ray is to break the text is that in the text Brassiere tries to think whether it's possible, like thinks that there's possibility, there is the possibility to understand what mediations are positive and negative under capitalism. And for Dimitra, this is a kind of rational form of liberalism, especially in the sense when Brasier brings the notion of the need for certain forms of impersonality. For Gotosa, this is a way of like, okay, who will be administrating, well, impersonality, but also recognition that this will be needed in the process of what we can do now. But for Dimitra, this is problematic, because what is this type of recognition if it's not a form of liberal form of recognition under today's? And then it's also, I think, kind of, she's also criticizing the kind of rationalism that Brasier is bringing about in this, trying to identify what mediations are good and bad. So then Dimitra, Marina Bismitz also brings other, as she has done, very important issues to the question, which is like the difference between the different understandings of we that we start from, that is absolutely very irregular, and we come from very different forms of exploitation and different understandings of subjectivity, or even non-subject, like in the case of Fred Montan, when he describes the role of the slave in production capitalist development. So, okay, then we have a reply by Ray Brasier, and he takes some into account some of these criticisms, especially his Cotosus. So, Brasier replies back, taking into account the criticisms mentioned above. The question for Brasier is, what kind of conception of personal singularity is taking place at the starting point? For him, the singularity of persons remains a metaphysical abstraction rooted in theology, and its only material qualities are the ones based on its socio-economical status, often backed by the state. For Brasier, we can understand the process of abolition in Hegelian terms as sublation. Sublation abolishes positive immediacy, but keeps the negativity that implodes from inside. It keeps the difference between the immediate and its mediation, but it destroys its positive immediacy, its identity. This does not mean to go from wrong to right, but to wrong, from wrong to right wrong. What is kept is a form of negativity that is actually the truth of its abolition, its contradictoriness. Then he comes back to the notion of the I and we, and he claims that there is the necessity from the certain form of recognition, the I in the we and the we in the I. But I guess what we have to take into account that if he has this very kind of Hegelian understanding of this sublation, this will constantly be in the process of sublation. So they are not stable, nor they are ontological. One might criticize this understanding of self-abolition or sublation as ideal or Hegelian, but then in a recent text, I think he brings some notions that are helpful to understand it in materialist terms and to follow. He's not doing that link, but I'm trying to make the kind of link. So, on the one hand, we have two different forms of totality. In the book, we have a critique of the totalizing notions of subsumption, which have been described before. But I guess one of the most clear is the one coming from Rob Lucas, even though Marina is also addressing it. So So here, subsumption understood here is only happening in the valorization process. This means that there is a form of human activity that needs yet to be commodified. Living labor, which is not yet part of the wage relation. Therefore, it is not yet subsumed. This is a critique of a form of totality. Okay, there is something that is outside of real subsumption. But there is another form of totality which fetishizes social relations and the categories that we use to conceive ourselves. This is what has been historically called reification, Verdinglichung. Relations between people transpose as relations between things. This is a perverted inversion between subjects and objects. Objectified relations such as money become an active agent, and the subjective powers of our living labor become objectified and rendered passive. Even if some of our practices are not yet commodified, the way that we conceive ourselves is through this perverted invention. So one totality is not total, but conditions the way that we conceive ourselves. In the first totality, at the level of practice, there is an activity outside of the valorization process. But on the second totality, reification totally conditions our consciousness and our self-understanding. How is this happening, and what room does it give us to maneuver? In this recent text, Brasier brings Marx materialism, understanding of materialism, coming from the German ideology and the thesis of Auerbach. Consciousness is the inverted reflection of social relations. In order to identify how this perverted inversion occurs, we need to distinguish what is happening in thought and what is happening in practice. What is concrete and abstract in thought, and what is concrete and abstract in reality? In this text, Brasier points out the difference between living and dead labor is not a metaphysical contrast between authentic and inauthentic, or between lived and represented experience. Instead, it is a formal contrast between unconscious and validated practice and conscious, socially validated activity. The activity that is not yet commodified, i.e. subsumed, is an unconscious and validated form of activity which is not transparent to its practitioners, not theoretical consciousness. But in the process of commodification, at subsumption, it becomes socially validated. According to him, thought can represent the structure of practice, but there is no metaphysical correspondence, nor similarity or resemblance between the actuality of thought, concrete in thought, and the structure of practice, concrete in reality. Capitalism through commodification verifies the unconscious practices as a conscious socially validated practice, but this verification is an act done in practice. But this implies also that this is done under its categories, the inverted reflection, which mimics the fragmentation of the commodity form. Under capitalism, our understanding of humanity as persons is necessarily dissociative. This dissociation has to do with the contradictory qualities of capitalism. On the one hand, it constantly tries to reduce socially necessary labor in order to increase surplus labor time by anticipation of the working day and technology, and developing different forms of subsumption, more intense forms of subsumption. But simultaneously, capitalism is absolutely dependent on labor power. Therefore, it constantly generates the internal obstacle to its own reproduction. This is a crucial distinction because it helps us to understand that even if there are forms of activity that are not yet commodified, we don't seem to have the categories that allows for our emancipatory potential, nor it makes sense to reaffirm the identities that we have today, because their verification, i.e. social validation, is filtered through commodification and subsumption. And some of the conclusions that I'm trying to draw from this understanding of this difference between concrete in thought and concrete in reality. So, okay, on the one hand, for Marx, understood in this sense, is all the practices are the subject, all the practices that are happening, but we are not conscious of it. So it takes the the validation at the moment is happening through capitalism, through the inverted reflection that capitalism produced through reification. So it's like, okay, and the level of practice there is outside of the totality of, let's say, real subsumption, but when then concrete in thought kicks in and the validation that happens is totally filtered through the reification process. So that allows that the category, that means that the categories that we have are totalizing. The practices is absolutely determined by this totalizing process. What does this mean? I think this critique, it allows for a critique of the ontologization that Marina mentioned before, of some of the ontologization happening in Afro-pessimism. The way that we can actually get of this hold of this process of social validation, I'm still wondering how it cannot help us. So, okay, the final conclusion that I'm trying, you know, it's not very final. It's just very simple. Well, it's very extremely limited. Okay, the contradiction between what we do and what we are is totally dictated by the dissociative qualities of capitalism. This generates fragmentation, different forms of identity that suffer different forms of oppression, discrimination, and exploitation. But the differences of these identities are not essential, nor empirical, nor are only happening in thought. They are reproduced in practice. The self-abolition becomes necessary, but this does not mean that we go from a wrong to a right, as it was before, but we go to a right-wrong. So this, what I take it, is this process of self-abolition is continuous under the forms that we are in capitalism. It would have to take some specific form and taking into account the kind of the different forms of the we that we have and the different understandings, it will change. But it's not that we are it's not that we come from something already prefigured. It's not that we will go to something already. It's not that we come from something that it was there before. Not that we go to some kind of theological position of an alienated life. It's a process that is constantly occurring, that it constantly has this negative, actually, I think it has to do with the negative agency that Marina has been talking about it. And I think that's like a kind of, but I thought that this has to do with the role of an understanding of alienation as the kind of core of keeping the self-abolition happening, of understanding this sublimation as having its, in essence, its contradictoriness.